Welcome back to the foundation course. And as you know, we've been going through quite in depth into the foundation of a Buddhist practice, what Buddhism is all about. And for the majority part of the course, it's been on really practical kind of approach to Buddhism and the main essential points to at least get our head around. The nature of the mind, karma, death and rebirth, and how to develop a good heart. And last week and this week now, we're diving into what's called the view of reality. And this is what's unique to Buddhism. You won't find this anywhere else. Maybe in, you know, close to it in some quantum physics and possibly close to it in some philosophy, metaphysics, but otherwise the view is what's really unique to Buddhist understanding of life, the universe and everything, and how we can relate to the world. And it's all focused around or directed by the point of how do we end suffering? How do we end our problems? How do we overcome problems? So it's not just kind of like a philosophical discussion for the sake of curiosity or kind of intellectual titillation. It's really powered by this incredible need that we have to not suffer, and this yearning for happiness and safety and meaning and all of those things. So I'll just check if that's a lost person on the email before we get started. Yes, it is. Just in the nick of time. Right, I've just sent a link. So that reminds me to say to everybody that if the link hasn't arrived, you know, 5 or 10 minutes before class starts, rather than panicking, just always email me and I can send it to you personally. So let's set our motivation. I like to begin setting a motivation, even in a very informal way, of just thinking the two wings of the bird. On one side we have curiosity and on the other side we have care. So, you know, curiosity, setting our motivation to really develop our wisdom, and in particular the wisdom that can liberate us from suffering and all of its causes. And then care, having care for oneself and care for others. So with a really good heart of the whole purpose of any form of investigation like this, Buddhist kind of study, is to be able to care in the ultimately best possible way for ourselves and others. So that's the compassion wing, the wing of bodhicitta. All right, so, and also just before we get started, when we come back next week, we'll start with some meditations as well. But this week, because I'm so excited about the topic, I think we're just going to just jump straight in. And to get started, I wanted to find out, have any of you heard of the Heart Sutra? The Heart of Wisdom Sutra, or even the Diamond Cutter Sutra. So Daryl has, that's good. Because many of the, yep, Lucy thinks it sounds familiar, okie dokie. In particular, the sutras that are to do with the wisdom realizing emptiness. So they're sutras about ultimate truth, and pretty much the Heart Sutra is one of the most famous ones. It's the Heart of Wisdom Sutra. And it's chanted at all of the Mahayana Buddhist temples in whatever tradition it is. So throughout China and Mongolia, Vietnam, Tibet, Australia, all of the Mahayana centers chant this sutra. And it is the Heart of Wisdom. So it is very condensed. And when you first hear it, I know when I first hear it, I just went, what is this? Because it sounds really outlandish and really out there. So I thought I'd start with that, and then we can go into how does that apply to our life. So the Heart of Wisdom Sutra, and what it is a conversation between Avalokiteshvara and Shariputra, inspired by the Buddha. So many of these sutras start by, you know, saying where they are, where they're sitting, who was there, and you kind of get this real feel for almost being there yourself. And this sutra, what's amazing about it is Avalokiteshvara, we know as Chenrezig, the Buddha of compassion. But even before Avalokiteshvara or Chenrezig became known as, you know, the enlightened manifestation of great compassion, his main focus was about wisdom. And so this conversation between Avalokiteshvara and Shariputra was there inspired by the Buddha. So just by the presence of the Buddha, they were able to really riff on a theme of ultimate reality. As what happens to us, you know, where there's someone there who we really love and they've changed our life and they come to visit, just everything about us kind of rises to the occasion, doesn't it? And so the Buddha actually didn't even say one word in this sutra. It's just like sometimes the analogy is when you have a gong hanging there, like a cymbal or a gong, and the wind blows and you can, it makes a sound. So no one's actually struck the gong at all, but still the sound comes. So that's like the Buddha didn't even say anything, but this entire sutra on the ultimate nature of reality came into being. So the longest version of it, the Prajnaparamita Sutra, is 100,000 verses long. The Heart Sutra is maybe 1.5 pages in English. And the shortest version of it is one syllable, ah, which I just find mind-blowing in itself. Mm-hmm. And so, like I said before, the view of reality, or the view understanding ultimate nature, relative nature, and how they fit together is what makes Buddhism unique. The views recognized in both the Pali and the Sanskrit traditions. And the obvious truth, ultimate view, hidden truth, method of the five paths. So within this sutra, there is laid out the entire Buddha's path. But the most obvious part in this sutra is the part where it's got all the lists of things and then says there's none of them. There is no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, and so on. And it goes through the Four Noble Truths. There's no truth of suffering. There's no truth of cause. There's no truth of cessation. There's no truth of path. And you're going through just going, what? There's no sickness, no aging, no death, and so on. So it itemizes all of the things that we normally relate to and said there is none. So the thing about this to recognize, and when we hear of emptiness within Buddhism or voidness, is to not fall into nihilism, because this sutra is from the ultimate point of view. So from the ultimate point of view, there is no eye, there is no nose and tongue and whatever. Of course, from relative point of view, there is, because I'm saying those words. But this is coming from an ultimate point of view. So the reason I've mentioned this is because I remember a dear friend of mine, when she first came to Lungri Tongpa Center and first came to Buddhism, and she read the Heart Sutra, and we read it at the beginning of teachings of the lamas. And she's like, oh, why is it so negative? Why does it have to be so negative? And when we first hear it, it can seem like that. And certainly when I first heard about emptiness or voidness, which is sometimes how it's translated in the older translations, I too thought it sounded really negative and really awful. But it's to do with the context. And actually in some other readings and some other traditions coming at it from a slightly different point of view, instead of it being called emptiness or voidness, it's called suchness. You could even go so far as saying fullness. So it just depends. There's a lot of nuances there. But whenever you hear this, know that, you know it's coming from the ultimate truth point of view. So, how to avoid nihilism? Because we take it, start where we are on a relative level. All phenomena do exist. It's not that they don't exist, but they exist in this particular way, interdependently, depending on other things. And so kind of this is another way of saying what we talked about last week. So then, therefore, from an ultimate level, all things are empty of existing in an independent way or an autonomous way or an unchanging way. So those two statements, the relative level and the ultimate level, they say the same thing, but they're coming at it from a different point of view. And like when we talked about last week, coming at things from a relative level, from interdependence, is a lot easier. And then we kind of do all of the work and then we come to the conclusion, aha, therefore, that means that ultimately all things are empty of existing in an independent way, an autonomous way or unchanging way. So let's see another way that we can come at this so that we don't fall into nihilism is to look at what emptiness is not. And I must admit, in my 20s, I was right into Western philosophy. And so I hung around with a lot of serious young men also into philosophy and into postmodernist thought and reading Nietzsche and Deleuze and Guattari and all of this, like, you know, really highfalutin stuff. And I found it so juicy and so interesting. But I also found that it's very, very easy to fall into nihilism. And many of the existentialists did fall into nihilism. Many of the materialists, when they think about it, also fall into nihilism. And it can be tempting to think even Nietzsche was a nihilist. But what we can do is look at what emptiness is not, to keep ourselves safe. And I think as beginners, it's really important. So we've got this ultimate view of reality that says ultimately all things are empty of existing in an independent way, for instance, or empty of existing in an unchanging way. So that doesn't mean that there's nothing that exists at all. And many times I've had a conversation with people going, oh, yeah, but nothing exists anyway, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it's because we've kind of gone too far. It's like we're a pendulum. We're all one way, and then we go bang right over to the other side. So don't ever think that nothing exists at all. It's just in the way that it exists. So rooms and people and classes on Zoom all exist. So emptiness isn't a blanket negation. In fact, when we say emptiness, what it is, it's code, it's shorthand. And when you're new to Buddhism and you first come across emptiness and you don't know it's shorthand, of course it appears as nihilism. The reason why it's really important not to fall into this early on is because if it sticks, it's really hard to undo that damage. It's kind of like if you're learning the piano and you have your hands in the wrong position from the beginning, And the teacher keeps on saying, lift your wrists. And over and over and over again. But if you learn the wrong way, it's almost impossible to change. So in particular with something like this, we don't want to fall into any of the extremes. So it's not a blanket negation. And what we've got to be careful of is actually what we are negating. And like we talked about last week, emptiness is negating a specific thing. And that's what we're going to have a lot of fun tonight, actually looking at what it's negating. How does that affect me in my day-to-day life? And what it's negating is that we don't exist in a concrete way. We don't exist in a solid kind of unchanging way. We don't exist in a vacuum by ourselves independently. We don't exist autonomously. We don't exist as a self-made man or a self-made woman, all of those things, which when we think about it, we go, oh yeah, that's true. But it's not what's at the forefront of our mind all the time, is it? Here's another one that's often bandied about. Things are not an illusion, but they are like an illusion. So this was another thing that I've often heard people refer to dismiss problems. Often when they're feeling a bit emotionally overwhelmed and they'll go, oh yeah, but everything's an illusion anyway. And so that's actually not quite correct because that's like a negation of everything again, isn't it? Actually, everything is like an illusion. And I really love this one because when we say things are like an illusion or like a mirage, it's got a lot of nuances in it because optical illusions, mirages, they do exist. We enjoy them. We even go and like pay to see magic shows to see optical illusions. So they do exist. But the frisson that happens is because they don't exist in the way they appear. And that's the real beauty of it. So our whole life does exist, but like an illusion, it appears one way, but it exists in another way. So they say with emptiness, when we start thinking about it, we can have one of two kind of responses. One of it is we can get really excited about it, and the other is we can get really scared. And it reminds me of this TV show that I've been watching. Oh, I can't remember. It's really late night, and it's one of those street magicians that goes around doing these tricks with the pedestrians, and they are really mind blowing. I don't know how they do them. You know, talking to them about what their favorite movies are and whatever, and then just reaching into the video shop behind him and picking up something and going, is this it? And it's, you know, it's not. They look at the cover, he opens it up, and there's her favorite movie and his favorite movie inside. And so what you see is one of two reactions. One is just like total glee, like, how did you do that? And the other is complete horror. How did you do that? So that moment when you've been bamboozled in a magic trick, it's like a Zen moment, isn't it? Everything just dissolves. Your grasp of reality dissolves. And it's like it tickles your mind. So that's what, when we start investigating emptiness and how things actually exist, that feeling comes up. And it can be like a magic trick where you know you've been tricked and you know it can't exist that way and yet it still appears that way to you. Or it can be like getting spiritual vertigo where you're terrified. But either one is a good sign. So things are like an illusion. And it's really important to keep that little word in there, they're like an illusion. They exist in the same way that illusions do, which is, you know, appearing one way but existing in another way. And when the really nice thing about this analogy of the illusion is that if you're driving through the Nullarbor in Australia and you're dying of thirst and you see that shimmering lake up ahead, you may be tempted to keep on driving till you get there, till you get to water. And people do, don't they? They believe the mirage. And it's the problem comes from believing it and chasing after it. And then you get to where it is and it's not there. It's further on. And that's how people get lost in the desert. So the problem isn't actually the appearance. The problem is the grasping at it and believing it to be true. So that happens with mirages when you're lost in the desert, and it happens with everything in our life. Every single problem that we have stems from this, grasping at things to be true. And it's really the belief that creates all of our suffering. So in the Heart Sutra, where it goes, know this, know that, whatever, it's kind of blowing up the mirage, the idea. It goes through all the things we grasp to and go, this is how it is. And it goes, not that. And then you go, oh, yeah, but what about this list of things? It goes, not those either, until everything's covered, life, the universe, and everything is covered. So that's the emptiness side of things. And hopefully this will help you avoiding nihilism. Even if you haven't actually read much about emptiness yet, I really hope this comes to mind when you do, that you are aware of this kind of nuance in it. So yeah, why it's put in the negative is to break down our mistaken view. So then let's have a look at selflessness then, which is applying emptiness to ourself. And this is where we start as Buddhists, because His Holiness the Dalai Lama has said, you know, all of our problems, we are the center of all of our problems. So if we want to solve our problems, we've got to start with ourselves. It's no good starting with some highfalutin philosophical view if we can't pull it into our life and kind of bridge it to our own experience. So the whole point of having this very sophisticated understanding of reality is to solve our problems. And so that's why we start by applying it. It's like applied emptiness is to look at ourselves and see how there is no independent, autonomous, permanent, solid self there after all. So selflessness. So what this means when we come at it from an emotional point of view is that the way that we feel is not actually the way that we are. So all of our instincts and how we feel emotionally, our way that we hold to our identity, all of that, they're really strong feelings, but they're not necessarily in step with reality. So how we feel is independent. You know, we feel like we are ourselves, everyone else is out there. We can end up feeling quite lonely and alienated like that too, where in actual fact, we are interconnected with everybody. We can feel permanent. We feel like we're the same day in, day out. And then we see a photograph of ourselves and go, oh God, I look old. So we feel permanent. We feel the same age over and over and over, even though everything's changing. And we feel solid and substantial, like this is me, whereas actually we know, you know, all the cells in our body change over every 7 years. So where is that me anyway? So how we feel just conventionally isn't quite in tune with reality. So Lama Yeshe says, how do I interpret myself right now? So this is how to come at it from an experiential point of view. To even recognize that how we feel about ourselves is an interpretation is a really good start, because it loosens things up And therefore, it loosens things up for change and possibility and solving our problems. So Lama Yeshe said, you know, take a long, close look at how you perpetrate a particular image of yourself, your supposed identity, what you imagine to be an abiding, substantial self. So he came up with this amazing analogy. You know, we might be emanating, if we're feeling a bit stupid, we might be, you know, emanating as a sheep, and if we're feeling a bit greedy, we might be emanating as a pig. You know, if we're feeling a bit flighty or a bit nervous, we might be emanating as whatever, you know, all of these different kind of personality styles and ways that we feel about ourselves. And we may hold very strongly to an idea of ourselves as being stupid or no good or not worth anything. Or we may have really fought very hard to have a strong sense of self-worth or identity in the face of, you know, difficulties growing up or at work or at school. So again, we're coming to this thing of when we feel, oh, I'm ugly or I'm old or I'm stupid or I can never learn, where the suffering comes into that is that we hold to that tightly, whether we like it or dislike it. We really feel it to be true and permanent and solid. So this is quite nuanced too, because we often think, oh, it's because other people have always told me that. You know, other people haven't acknowledged me, or other, you know, my parents told me I was stupid, I never amount to anything. So that's actually the condition, the reason it sticks. How come it affects us so much? How come it hurts us so much? Is because we grasp at that to be true. So you can you see how this is really doing a U-turn from, instead of just taking from what other people say, it's going, well, how come it wasn't water off a duck's back? How come it affected me so much? And it affects us so much because we hold to these things as being true. And so we might think that we're no good, or we might think that we're better than everybody. We might think, I'd never be able to become a Buddha. I'd never be able to do that. Many people, before they become parents, think, oh, I'd never be able to do that. And then they become parents and then they have to do that, and they surprise themselves how much you go above and beyond for others. So before we're challenged, we really hold tightly to an identity of who we are. So I was in my 20s, I kind of got an inkling of this, where I realized, oh, who am I actually is just like a whole collection of reactions, just reactions to circumstances. Who I am depends on what happens to me and how I react. So it kind of got me searching to, well, who am I really? So this question, who am I really? I think it's really important that we don't mix up ultimate reality and conventional reality. Because on a conventional level, you know, we do exist, we function, we have very different personalities, very different interests, very different ways of responding. But what happens is that we take those vast array of differences to be the real me. So we take that conventional level of existing to be the ultimate me and grasp at that as the ultimate me. And this is where all the confusion and the suffering comes in. So I'm just going to stop here for a moment and ask, what questions do you have so far? Just anything at all that's come up from this discussion. You can wave at me, turn your camera on, wave, or you can put it into the chat, whatever you like. Lucy, go for it.
I'm just wondering, like, if this is how it is, why are humans so wired to you know, identify with the me so strongly? Is it just like, I guess it's survival, but it's, I don't know, it's just
You know, being able to relate with the world and see dangers and, you know, threats and opportunities and all of that, that all exists on a conventional level, and it's important to be able to relate like that. But why we are so wired to think that that's how things really are forever and a day is habit. So from Buddha's point of view, we'd say karma. That's the result. That's karma in action. So part of karma is habitual responses, habitual ways of looking at things, habitual feelings. And so we have habitual ignorance and habitual confusion. And so much of it's just the momentum of that habit. So I'll give you a really simple example. You know, at school we learn about atoms. Now, how many times do we think about that when we pick up our coffee cup or we drop it and it smashes? So we know it, but we're just not habituated. What we're habituated to is that coffee cup right here.
Don't smash it.
And I think it exists, you know, really and autonomously and permanently. And so when it smashes, I get a shock. So when it smashes, I should go, of course. But that never happens, does it? And that's the force of habit. So that's like, you know, how we experience karma playing out. And from a Buddhist point of view, then we'd say that then our brain is wired that way as a result. Our brain being wired that way isn't a cause. It's the result. It's the mind comes first and it wires the brain in a particular way. And that's quite different from a materialist point of view, but it is actually a neuroscience point of view. And so right in there is the key, because we can change. We can rewire our brain.
Yeah.
So, you know, if we grasp at existence, that our identity is true and real, ironically, the result is that we're always intimidated. We're always disappointed and scared and rigid. It's a tragedy, isn't it? Whereas if we actually recognize dependent arising, that's how we get resilience. And that's how we see opportunities when things change. So, yeah, what holds us back is this really bad habit of believing appearances.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lucy. So let's see, we've got selflessness and it means that we are empty of an inherent self, empty of a permanent self, empty of a independent self. Who am I really? We'd say we're the mere I. So the conventional I. And this is totally the opposite of how we feel. So I've got a little reflection here that we can do. You know, a nice little house with a picket fence and a garden and, you know, the American dream, we may as well say the Australian dream too, of, you know, house and 2.5 kids and all of those things. And many times people have said to me, you know, I don't want much. I just want what they've got. I just want what others have. So how come we have that yearning? You know, we look at a group of people laughing and we think, oh, I want that. I want that human connection or that friendship group or that happy family or that perfect job or that gorgeous house with a picket fence. So apart from just going and watching a whole lot of David Lynch movies, which will put you off picket fences forever, actually where we can see where the problem comes from, this one is this really big mistake that we make of thinking that all of our happiness comes from out there, from those things. So we think that we think of those things and we think they'll bring us happiness. So this is how Rinpoche explains how it happens. There's this whole process. So we've got ignorance or confusion, past ignorance. It's called innate ignorance because we just don't know better. Just like when we were a kiddie, we didn't know about atoms. And so because of that ignorance that we have, it leaves an imprint on our mind. And that imprint on our mind, what it does is it decorates objects, or it projects onto them expectations. It's a hallucination, though. It's not there. And it does this for ourselves too. It projects or hallucinates or has expectations about who I am, the I, who we are. And what it does, that ignorance or that habitual kind of momentum of believing appearances, it believes this I to be real. So we think a real house and a real job and a real happy family, the real ice cream and real money. And we have no idea that it's a hallucination. So on an ultimate level, there is nothing to become attached to or to yearn for, because there is no real house and no real money and no real job and no real perfect family and no real me either. So this is the premise. And when we try and find the real me or the, you know, the perfect job, all of those things, and we can't find it, that's called the emptiness of the object. And then we come back a little bit and we go, yeah, but it does exist. So how does it exist? By mere label, by imputation, by causes and conditions, by its parts. So this is how we can actually do this to make it applied. So I call it applied emptiness or applied selflessness. And there's this amazing way of actually meditating on this, because there is a process that we can go through to undo that fogginess in our mind and to undo that habitual looking at reality and believing it to be how it appears. And it really takes a lot of effort to undo that mistake, but it's worth it, because it's that mistake that makes us suffer. It's that mistake that creates all of the suffering that we experience in life. So this is a little bit from Rinpoche, Lama Zorin Rinpoche. He says, it's in the most recent of the Copan teachings that he's been doing online, that ignorance holding the I as real is the root that keeps us circling in samsara. Rinpoche goes on to say that the wrong view of the real I that appears, this real I, this, you know, sense of the real I appears when we are frightened. So that's how we can tell we've kind of identified the mistaken I. The root of our circling in samsara depends on the ignorance holding the I, the me. And in order to cut that, you need to generate the wisdom realizing no self or selflessness. Hearing this, people might get confused and ask, what? There is no I. I do not exist. No, Rinpoche says, it's not like that. Here we're discussing the real I or the real me, and it's the object of refutation. What is to be refuted is an I existing from its own side. Pabongka Rinpoche says that things do not exist in the way they appear to us or the way we hold them. They totally do not exist from their own side. So, for instance, pleasure, all the things that we become addicted to or have desire for, it's not there. People become involved in so many problems, being addicted to things, drugs, alcohol, sex, killing. And these so-called pleasures are a total hallucination. It's like we become addicted to creating suffering for ourselves. When we learn emptiness and selflessness, that helps us control our desire. It stops us from becoming addicted to so many things. How does it stop us? By enabling us to see that they do not exist in the way they appear to us. So I learnt this with hangovers. You know, how many times do I look at a bottle of Plonk and go, ah, oh, fantastic, great, I can't wait to get into that. And then the next morning, wake up totally surprised that I had a hangover. How did that happen? You know, I couldn't put two and two together until eventually after about, you know, 10, 15 years, now I look at a bottle of Plonk and I see the happiness and the hangover at the same time. But you can see how we get addicted to things because we're just so biased. We just see how it first appears. We don't see the whole story. So let's have a look at how we actually meditate on selflessness, and then I'll give you some examples. So the way that we do it is what's called Nagarjuna's four keys. So this is a really powerful tool. It's a logical tool. It is irrefutable. And you may find yourself getting really wriggly about it, but that's okay because it's difficult to hold ourselves to a logical proposition. And if we use the right sequence, we won't fall into nihilism. We'll actually come to a realization. And when we use these four keys, what happens is we find that there's a discrepancy between how we intellectually understand things and how we feel about things. And that discrepancy, it's okay to feel that. That's that emotional vertigo again, because it shows that we're changing, we're working on changing. So the four keys. First key is identify the object of negation. So what is it that's empty? What is it that's not real? So you've got to get the right target. What are we empty of, for instance? The second is establish the logical pervasion. Mm-hmm. So that is where the semantics come in. So we have the proposition. I'll go into these a little bit more in a moment. So that's where we set up the logical tool. This, it's like cutting through the confusion. And then we use the tool. One called ascertain the absence of oneness, and the other ascertain the absence of difference. So what are these four keys and what on earth do they mean? So first off, the object of negation. So this one, when we're talking about selflessness, what is it that we're negating? Got to take it nicely. So we're negating the object, that one, how Rinpoche said, when we feel frightened, that me that comes up. Or when we feel wrongly criticized or abuse, someone abuses us or yells at it, the sense of me that arises then, that's the object of negation. That really strong sense of me, how very dare they. What it's not is just the ordinary me that moseys along, oh, I think I'll go get a cup of coffee. That's just the conventional me, and that's okay. There's no problem there. The problems arise with that really strong sense of grasping at a me. And so often they'll say how to actually find the object of negation is sit down in meditation, imagine something really scary happening or someone yelling at you and criticizing you for something you didn't do. And immediately this sense will arise, no, I didn't. So that one that says, no, I didn't, that's the object of negation, that really strong feeling. It can also be when we're having a really tough time, the one that says, I can't take it anymore. I'm sorry, I'm laughing. It's just black humor. I mean, we've all felt it, haven't we? So that's that I, that's the object of negation. That's the one that doesn't exist in the way it appears. Meaning when we say, I can't take it anymore, that sense of me does not exist in the way that we feel. It's a feeling, but it's not true. So what does Lama Yeshe says? Lama Yeshe says a little bit about this. Our mind has been so accustomed to viewing things in a distorted manner that it is difficult to gain a clear picture of reality. And because our wisdom is so limited, it's hard enough to recognize our mistaken beliefs, much less the actual state of things. For instance, if we ask ourselves, what exactly is this I that I'm always talking about? We shall have great difficulty in formulating an answer. This is so despite the fact that we think in terms of I and me all the time, even in our dreams when we're asleep. Our delusions, our confusion is so thick that we cannot even explain what we are accustomed to seeing. So identifying the object of negation, it's a tricky one. We talk about me this and I this and I that, you know, it's the most repeated word in the English language. And yet when we, you know, actually trying to identify, it's quite tricky. So the object of negation is that really strong one. And then we go, then we assert in the logical pervasion. And this is where we set up the parameters of it. And I think it's quite similar to in Western science where you have something is called the iron rule. And it's like, you know, evidence and logic. So whether you like the result or not, doesn't matter. You've set up the parameters. And this is what the logical pervasion is. A person is made up of a body and a mind. So the self must exist as either one with the body and mind or separate from the body and mind. There's no third alternative. It can't show up some other place. So that's the parameters, isn't it? Selflessness. So I'm trying to find where's this self? Okay, so this self must exist either as part of my body, part of my mind, you know, one with my body or one with my mind, or separate. Is there any other possibility? There's no other possibility. It's like, oh, where are my glasses? My glasses are either in this room or outside of this room. There's no other possibility. So what's so wonderful about this tool is that if you look for my glasses in this room and they're not there, and we look for them outside of this room and they're not there, they're gone. If we look for ourselves inside our body, inside our mind, apart from body and mind, and we can't find it, it's gone. So how do we do that? And this is where it gets really fun. And we can go back to those three levels of dependent arising. So I'll just find, here we go. So the selflessness of the I. So let's go, okay, let's be a materialist and go, okay, I am my body. So the me exists in my body. So the body, here we have, the body's made up of causes and conditions. So the DNA. So we can't just solely be our DNA, because some of it comes from our mother and some of it comes from our father, and yet we're distinct from them. And our body, how our DNA is expressed, depends on the environment, doesn't it? We might get the DNA, the perfect DNA, from our parents, but if we have a poor diet or a polluted environment, how our body turns out is quite different. So we look at our body, it's dependent on these causes and conditions. But we still think, oh yeah, but regardless, my body's still me. We don't, even though we say my body, we still think it's me. Then we think, oh, okay, so the body is me. The body is made up of parts, you know, a heart and a liver and a lungs. And up until very recently with organ transplants, people thought, you know, the seat of the soul or the mind or whatever was physically in the body. So often we think, oh, it's in the heart. Apparently the ancient Egyptians thought that the soul or the me was in the liver. So my friend Pearlie Black and Leah Cottrell, great singers in Brisbane, they did this show where they got all of the songs about the heart, you know, Affair of the Heart and Total Eclipse of the Heart, and all of the songs that mention the heart, and just changed the word to liver. Total Eclipse of the Liver, all the way through. So it kind of points out the absurdity that how can we be one of those places? Also, when we have organ transplants, you know, you have a kidney transplant or a liver transplant or a heart-lung transplant, you still feel you're you. So we can't be the parts. And when people lose their limbs, you know, they lose an arm, for instance. So it's not like they've lost them, they've just lost an arm. So we can't be the parts of the body either. If we were the body, and the body's made of parts, if I lost an arm and it was thrown out of the rubbish, I'd say I am in the rubbish. But we don't, do we? We just say my arm is in the rubbish. So then it's like, oh, okay, which part of me is me? And we think, oh, you know, now we think, oh, it's the brain. But again, which part of the brain? You can lose 80-90% of your brain matter and still function very well as a human being, because the brain rewires itself. So which part of the brain? So you can see how we're narrowing it down of like, who's the real me? Where's the real me? And we come at each layer more subtle. And in terms of the body, then we go, oh, well, you know, we exist in mere name, actually, how we identify. We conventionally have the ladies and gents toilets, but actually what we have is gender fluidity. So where is the real me? So we've looked for the real me in our body. And while it seems really obvious, here I am, when you start looking, it just disappears. So that is a good sign. The non-finding of something when it's sought analytically is the emptiness of that object. So we've got this me, we're saying it's the body, and we're trying to find it, and it disappears. That's the emptiness, that's the selflessness. So I cannot be the body. So I'm just going to stop here and see what questions do you have. I mean, you can see, you know, with a identifying ourselves as the body, the me as the body, can bring so much suffering, can't it? Because as we age, then we feel there's something wrong with us. If we get sick, we feel like, you know, our body's turned against us. It's, you know, we've betrayed. And if we identify with the body, like those poor people on those shows like Botched, you know, with the plastic surgery, then spending hundreds of thousands of dollars to fix up how the body looks, thinking it's them. Which, you know, it's so incredibly sad because it can only end badly. And the thing is that we are not the body, are we? But I want you to play devil's advocate and say, no, but we must be. So come on, who's got something to say? Christine, yes, go for it.
It's one of those things, isn't it, because you go, I'm not the body. And as you were saying, if you lose a limb or if you lose parts of your body, but then at what point, like you can have the transplants of generally everything, but you can't transplant your brain.
No, you can't transplant your brain yet, but nevertheless, when they're trying to find, you know, they generally say, oh, this part of the brain does this and this part of the brain does that. But yeah. When people have a brain injury, the brain rewires itself and a different part of the brain takes over and does the same job. So whilst they try and find emotion in a brain cell, can't be found. Because the brain is like the machine. It's a tool, but it's not the thing.
Yeah. So does that then become, if the brain is going to get rewired, do you become a different me?
Well, that's a good question. So, I mean, people had this thought with, you know, if I get a liver transplant, will I be a different person? Will I be half me and half that other person? You know, people get really spooked about that, don't they? And with heart transplants too, they think, oh, I'm me, but I've, and there's how many movies about that, that then they're haunted by the other persons, you know, who had the heart before them.
Because it's quite interesting. I've got we've got a family member who had leukemia and had a bone marrow transplant. And since then, there's behaviours and stuff that have changed. And he's found out because the bone marrow transplant came from a fellow, I think it was in Denmark or a European country. And also, like his eye colour has changed.
Yeah.
His skin colour has changed. You know, it's like he's, we found out that the fellow had, we don't know whether he was dark skinned, but our relative is now becoming more tanned in his.
Right.
So there you go.
So there's
changing.
Yeah. Causes and conditions. So you think, oh, this is me, but you change the conditions, like the bone marrow transplant, and then the me, you know, you're no longer a whitey, maybe you're a Negro. So where's the me?
Well, that's
who am I really?
Yeah, it's sort of like it shifted. He's sort of still there, but he's now got different characteristics of who he was, and even different behaviors. Like, he used to love seafood and now he gets violently ill when he eats seafood. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
like that. Yeah.
So much of who we think we are is just causes and conditions, and we think it's us. We think, oh, you know, I like seafood, but actually, it's nothing to do with this sense of I. It's just causes and conditions. They change, and now I don't like seafood. So that can't be the me. So then we look further. So what is the me? But where the suffering comes is if we grasp onto that as the me, and so then we feel, you know, me, I'm losing me. Whereas actually it was never there to start with. It was just causes and conditions.
The other
question, how we respond to the parts, to the environment.
I've got another question, maybe just with, you know, when I suppose we say this is who I am in a job. So we identify ourselves as something or other. And then when you shift that, you go, or you don't have that job and you're in transition, you go, I don't really know who I am. You know, you become,
yes.
Yeah, you don't have that identity. And then you go onto another job and you go, oh, I'm this. But then the other thing too is when someone says, if you find your passion, you'll be happy. You know, you yes. find your passion, and then you will, as a person, will be happy and everything will be okay. But then you're always seeking for that passion and you never really find it. So you're always trying to find that.
There's two things in that. So one, when you find your passion, you're happy because you release that sense of self.
Okay.
That's why you're happy, because you're so involved in something that the sense of ego is gone and the sense of separation between me and other, me and the activity is gone. You are one with the activity. You're harmoniously with it. You're intimately connected. And that's why we feel happy, because that sense of me, I, has dissolved. And we can tell, because sometimes then it degenerates and we start thinking, oh, I'm so great, or you have your passion and then you want everyone to recognize how good you are at it. And this sense of me starts creeping in, and then we start having a crisis of faith or feeling intimidated or suddenly dissatisfied again.
Yeah.
So the actual loving your passion is because we just release that sense of me, and therefore that sense of separation goes. So of course we're happier. But the other one, the first thing that you mentioned, I'm so glad you did, because that's then looking at the mind. So, you know, the body, we can go through and we can see a whole lot of absurdities. If we think we are the parts of our body, that's absurd. If we think we are the causes and conditions, that's such an excellent example that you gave of how we change, say, with a bone marrow transplant, you know. So what we thought was us, our identity, changes. Now, with the mind, again, we've got causes and conditions. So who we are is largely shaped by what happens to us, our experiences. If we had a nurturing upbringing or we had an abusive upbringing, it's going to change who we are and how we relate to the world. And we think that's us, but actually it's our circumstances. And so much suffering just comes from this, because if we think, if you know, we're totally dependent on those circumstances for our identity, then we're beholden to our circumstances. We're addicted to whatever happens, you know, those pleasurable things. Whereas if we realize how we feel about ourselves, our state of mind is dependent on causes and conditions, then we can change. We can put in place different causes and get different results. So we might think we're this type of personality or that type of personality. I'll give you an example. You know, before I came to Lungri Tumpa Center, I was a certified introvert, highly introverted, and spent many, many hours by myself, making costumes and all sorts of things. Every now and again, I'd come out from my den. Coming to Lungri Tungpa Center and being forced to interact with human beings and be on reception and speak on the phone, I slowly, like I fake it till you make it, until it slowly became more habitual, second nature. And so from years ago when I did the Myers-Briggs typology and came out way, way over on the introverted side of things. A few years ago where I did the Myers-Briggs typology again, I came out exactly smack bang in the middle, X, in between introvert and extrovert. So my entire personality has changed through my circumstances changing. So you kind of think, oh, that's the real me, but again, it can't be. If you go and live in another country with a different culture, how you are and how people respond to you changes, and then you change. So, so much of who we are depends on our causes and conditions in our mind. And if we're brought up in, you know, have a difficult time when we're brought up, for instance, when you're growing up, your family was quite poor, then along with that comes this feeling of battling, of always being scared that there's not enough, of not feeling worthy. So we take those conditions and we believe them to be true. So, you know, if you're brought up kind of rich and fantastic education and, you know, lots and lots of support, you might think that that's you, but actually it's the conditions. And if those conditions change, you can have a crisis of confidence. So my ex-husband, you know, he grew up on a farm, drove from about the age of 12 or 13. And then around about the age of 40, after all those years of driving, smashed the car and suddenly couldn't drive anymore and basically had a nervous breakdown, because his whole identity, who he thought he was tied up with being able to be free and drive wherever you wanted to. And now suddenly being beholden to the vagaries of public transport and being highly dependent on others for a lift, his whole sense of who he was disintegrated. And he had no idea what was happening, or that it was even tied to the fact that he just didn't have a car anymore. So much of who we think we are is our conditions, and we think that's me. And we only realize it when they change. I mean, the good thing is too that if you've had a difficult upbringing and then you actually are able to finally put yourself in a nurturing circumstances and think of things in a different way, you can actually change. So, you know, both sides, the change is actually a really good thing. But, you know, I look at who I am, so much of who I am is because I'm tall. I often think, what if I had gone through my life, all the same things happened, you know, wild clothes and funny hair and whatever, but I was short. How everyone would have responded to me would have been completely different. And so I would have been completely different. They also say, and this is a one on side of the body, of course, that teeth, if you've got good teeth, you're much more likely to be promoted at work. If you've got bad teeth, much less likely to get the job. So there again, that's not something that people consciously hold to, but because we, as you know, believe the appearances, then it has all of these consequences for us. But you know, with the mind, you might be able to look back at your own life and have another look and go, well, you know, what if those things hadn't happened? Would I still be me? And if you go no, then who is the real me if not causes and conditions? There is no real me. So then we can go another layer deeper to look at the parts. And this one, Christine, is where you said pretty much all the different hats that you wear. You might work as a nurse or as a fireman or firewoman. In your downtime, you might be a scoutmaster. You might volunteer somewhere. You also maybe a parent, you know, a mother or a father. You're also always the child of your parents. They always see you as the baby, never as a grown up. So who we are in terms of our mind is also made up of parts. So, you know, who am I? Am I an artist? Am I just a crazy crochet queen? Am I a class leader? Am I an IT guru? Am I a shy introvert? what else? Like, am I an ex-Press Hill independent school, what do they call them, alumni? Am I a Queenslander? Am I an Australian? Am I a Victorian? So the answer is, it depends. And yet, when we hold on to it really tightly, we forget that it depends. The ramifications of this are things like midlife crisis. We think we're young and now suddenly we're not. Or the empty nester syndrome. So you've identified so much with being a parent, and then the children, that, well, they don't grow up and leave now, do they? They just grow up and stay. But they used to grow up and leave. And then suddenly your whole sense of who you are is gone. And it's a real shock. And it's because we hold to these parts as being the real me. And yet they change over time as well. So the identity and the time changes. So we've kind of asserted, I'm not my body. And then, well, mind, we can see how, again, our mind, our experience all depends. The most subtle form of it is just in mere name. So I put here a picture of an artist because, again, you know, there's so many artists that when they were alive were just some hobo that lived down the road. Picasso, well, he was a bit of a rock star, but Van Gogh, you know, just some crazy dude that cut his ear off. So few artists actually found fame and fortune and were called artists at the time that they were alive. It's only once they're dead that they become famous artists, and then we go, oh, Van Gogh, and everyone knows who he is. But when he was actually alive, when he was him, he wasn't a famous artist. So again, in mere name, in acknowledgement, a label on a valid base. And this is why it's so difficult to be an artist, because many times if you're an artist, you're the only one in the world that thinks you are. Everybody else thinks you are just stop being a doll bludger or get a real job or stop being so eccentric or, you know, my two-year-old could paint that, all of those things, that all you've got left to hold on to is just mere name, just identifying as that. The other thing, of course, with the mind is that we think we are our mind, our experiences, until something goes wrong and then we go, oh, I lost my mind. I wasn't myself at the time. So we separate ourselves out from our mind. So in this going through the four keys, what we've done, we've gone, okay, the real me, it can either be one with the body and mind or separate from the body and mind. That's a logical pervasion. So we've seen it can't be one with the body and it can't be one with the mind. So therefore, it's got to be separate. So just go back to those keys. Therefore, it's got to be asserting the absence of difference. Therefore, the real me has to be separate from body and mind. And again, we can go to the absurdities of this. And, oh, that means that if we take away the body and we take away the mind, I'm still there. It's not possible, is it? Or we could put my body in that room, but I could be in here. So what's happening is that we have this discrepancy between how we feel, that habitual feeling of there must be a real me, and logically finding not possible. So again, I read it. The non-finding of something when it is sought analytically is the emptiness of that object. So the object, me, the emptiness of it cannot be found. Feels like it's there, but cannot be found. So the conclusion, if the real me exists, it's got to be either identical or totally separate from the body and mind. And if it's neither of those, then it can't exist, can't be found. So if your head feels turned inside out now, that's good, because that's what's supposed to happen. One of the examples that they gave for this that kind of puts it in perspective is going, if you've got a sheep, a goat and an ox, three things, you know, body, mind and me. You try and find the sheep by taking away the goat and the ox. So you take away the goat, you take away the ox, there's the sheep. So you take away the body, you take away the mind, there should be the me. But it's not there. So at this stage, I go, yeah, but who am I really? I've got to be somewhere. It's got to be like somewhere in there maybe or something like that. There's this inside. You're going, but. And that's the habitual grasping. And literally feels like you're clawing at straws, you know, to mix a metaphor. That habitual grasping, that's that whole karmic impetus there of confusion. So what I'd say with this, like Lama Yeshe says, you just stop and think, how am I interpreting myself at this moment? How am I interpreting myself right now? That's really the key to it. And you want to get to a stage where everything's been loosened up and you can't find the real me and really sit with that for a moment. Because that's what undoes the confusion. What we're doing is we're familiarizing our mind with something that's actually in accord with reality, and it's difficult at first. And the fact that that it is kind of so intense, that's actually, you know, evidence that we're changing. So when we talk about selflessness in Buddhism, this is how to meditate on it in this in a logical way that's irrefutable. You just can't wiggle out of it. So emotionally you're trying to wiggle out of it, but it can't be done, and that's what holds you there, and that's what develops the wisdom. Okay, so questions? Yes, Christine. Yep.
Actually, when you were just saying that about when you're trying to grasp onto it, when you're not the body and you're not the mind, and I actually felt a sense of panic, because it was like, I can't now, when you say that, I can't hold on to anything. And you actually feel quite stressed.
Yes.
Like, yeah. What do I attach to now? If it's not, when you sort of start to really think about it and you let your brain absorb it, it's quite frightening.
Yep.
Or maybe not, it's quite, you go, what do I do with that?
That's very good. So what you do with it is you sit with it. Because that urge to do something with it, that's the grasping. So you have that feeling and you sit with it, doing nothing, just sitting with it.
Okay.
Which really goes against all of our instinctual grasping, doesn't it? So you can see right there in that moment, you do all of this work, you get the target, you pull up all of the instances and you pull them away. And then you get to not finding a self in there. And then you go, what? Mm. And then stop. That's when you've got to stop and sit with that.
Okay. Not panic.
Panic's fine. Let the panic wash over you. It'll come, it'll go. Don't try and do anything with the panic.
Yeah.
So all of that, you know, way back mindfulness practices, just sitting with the breath, letting the thoughts come and go, that's what all of that practice is for.
Okay.
For this moment.
Use it
to
now.
Be able to sit with it and not freak out and actually have this new way of seeing reality become apparent to us in all of its nuances.
One more question.
Then,
you know, with when people have depression or all the mental health issues that we have, and we want to treat them and we want to fix that part of our mind because we say that it shouldn't be behaving like that. Is that different then to this? Like, or I know we can't let people suffer through mental health, but is it just society saying that the mind should behave in a different way? And we should treat it?
Yeah, so the reason why we have mental health issues and depression and anxiety comes from this grasping at a self that doesn't exist in that way. That's its root cause. But how it's expressed is like many, many steps up in terms of anxiety and dysfunction and, you know, and paranoia and depression and angst and all of those things. And in between, quite a lot of things has happened. So the reason we have depression and anxiety, that is because we have attachment. Mm-hmm. And we have attachment because we want things, you know, to be in a certain way, and we have that attachment because we think those things out there is what's going to fix me. If they change, if this changes. And we think our happiness comes from outside because we believe the appearance. I think my happiness comes from that bottle of champagne. And that's what it appears like, and that's what I believe. Mm-hmm. And the reason of that is because of this just habitual thinking the mirage exists how it appears. So you can see there's a lot of steps in there, and to wind it all the way back to the root cause, this mistaken grasping at an I. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind, though, that Lama Yeshe, you know, said that to do this kind of analysis, you have to be very mentally strong. So when you're in the throes of depression or anxiety, doing an analysis on emptiness, you've already have to have a whole lot of stuff in place for it to work. Actually, what you need is kindness, you know, and some really good help. And then in that moment, and there is usually a moment where you just release it all, then you can slot in the wisdom. But really for anxiety and depression, it's you know, I found that you've got to do the workings to go, it comes from attachment. And attachment comes from thinking my happiness comes from out there.
Something else, yeah. Yeah. Thanks, Miffy.
I mean, and sometimes you can, oh yeah, Philippa, in a sec. Sometimes you can just go straight to the emptiness when you have an aha moment, and you and people may realize, wow, you know, like I kind of had an aha moment when years ago when I was quite suicidal, and I was just thinking, oh, you know, there's no reason to live, and it's because of attachment, like I'd just been dumped by somebody, but I went through an analysis and I just thought, if there is no reason to live, then there is also no reason to die. So what am I going to choose? I have a choice here. So it really, you know, you come to your own aha moment somewhere, and in there is a space. And that is because of dependent arising, because there is no real me, then you can change. And most of the time we think all of that change and no real me, oh no, but actually that's our ticket out of suffering. Philippa.
Miffy, thanks. Yeah, I've been going through this for a few months and I've been going a bit, it's been very sort of destabilizing from what you thought you were. And then you're sort of in this flux and it's still quite strange. But I guess it's like too sort of, even when you're doing, say, Vajrasattva or you're, you know, talking to the deities, and then you think, oh my gosh, even the deities are empty. So that's sort of, you know, I guess for a bit of confusion and realignment and
yeah, so it's that shorthand, Philippa. So even you know, the Buddhas or the deities like Vajrasattva or Chenrezig, they're empty of inherent existence. So not empty as in not real, but empty of inherent existence, which means there is a chance that we too can become a Buddha because of that. Otherwise, it would be me and them and that's it. So the empty of inherent existence means there is the possibility of change.
Can we ask them for support?
Yes, of course, because things do function conventionally. So you go through this analysis of breaking down all the things that we are not. We're not our body, we're not our mind, we're not our circumstances, we're not our DNA, because, you know, like that great example of Christine, that can change, you know, get someone else's DNA. We're not all of these things. So not. So then who am I? Who are we? We are the mere I, the mere Philippa, the mere Miffy, which exists. But it exists in this much lighter, more flexible way of potential.
Okay.
So who we are at the moment is the mere Philippa and the mere Miffy. But, you know, when my life ends, the mere Miffy is gone. But this moment-by-moment experiencer continues. So who's that going to be? Whatever we're the most familiar with. So if we're the most familiar with resentment, that's what I'm going to be. And if we're the most familiar with the Buddhas, with Vajrasattva, with great compassion, then that's what you'll be. So there is this, and that's why Lama Tsongkhapa, and in this tradition, the Gelupa tradition, it's called the Middle Way, because it undoes all of this grasping at reality as being real, and then it just comes back just a tiny little bit to go, but yeah, there, but just in name. Just like gender fluidity, there, but just in name. Or who we are, there, but just in name.
Great. Thanks, Miffy. I got that.
So, I mean, this is heady stuff, isn't it? And I've had a really interesting time over the years because I've really loved reading about quantum physics, and I really loved reading Nietzsche and all the various postmodernist readings of Nietzsche. And all of this kind of converges right here onto this Buddhist understanding of reality. It's where it really becomes very, very parallel. Because in quantum physics, again, what it depends on is an observer. When you have an observer, things change. And actually, things don't exist unless you have an observer. You know, Schrodinger's cat in the box, or is it dead or alive? Well, it depends until someone actually observes it. So that's the scientific way of saying existing in mere name. So all of these, it's a very fine way of looking at reality. So Western science, the purpose of it, I suppose, is for inventions to make life better. The purpose of the Buddhist science of the mind is to eliminate suffering. That's the purpose, not to be right or dominate others or anything. It's purely to understand reality so that we're in step with reality and so we can eliminate suffering.
Wow. Yeah.
And so that's why we, you know, we do this whole analysis of selflessness to be able to help ourselves. It's like the ultimate compassion for ourselves. And I'm not sure if I said last week, but I'll say it again. You know, in science, we've got a kind of a bit of a progression of different views, and one view overrides another one, you know. So Newton's view throughout Galileo's view. You know, Galileo had Earth in the center of the universe and everything going around it. And Newton comes along and now it's, oh, actually, we're all going around the sun. Both of those views actually worked and functioned for a very, very long time. Galileo's one, you could still predict where the stars would be in the heavens, was just very complicated. Then Newton's view, you know, of kind of the large things in the world works fine. You get to quantum physics, it totally chucks out Newtonian physics. Totally different. So Western science is kind of getting more and more fine, and the view is still being developed, and they're still looking for the theory of everything. They're still trying to figure out how to tie Newtonian physics and quantum physics together because they contradict each other. And yet we live with it. But the Buddhist view ties those two together. It has conventional reality, how we exist and function. We are functioning beings. And it has ultimate reality, what our nature is, which is just merely labeled by mind on a valid base. And it beautifully ties the two together. So Geshe Zopa's often said, you know, that the view is finished, it's complete in Buddhism. It's there. We don't have to invent or discover anything else. It's all there. But that's also why it is so fine and nuanced, because we're getting down to that quantum physics level, but with the mind.
Wow. Yep.
So we've come to the end of this class, and well done everyone for sticking around. So I think for the next few classes we're going to branch out now into, well, what are the possibilities? Because, you know, if things exist merely labeled by mind on a valid base, then what that means is we have a choice of how we see reality, what we interact with, what we see is real and true and lasting, and what we can let go of. And this is where all the meditation practices and the tantric practices, like you mentioned, Philippa, Vajrasattva, Chenrezig practice, all of these come in. So we're going to start having a look at where tantra comes into things. And along with that is basically just how to set up a daily meditation practice. So how to sit comfortably, what prayers to do in the morning, how to bless your speech, you know, just really simple. It's like applying all of this now to a daily practice. Okay, so now a dedication. I hope you feel really happy about spending the time like this tonight, because what we've been looking at is, you know, the key to removing suffering and all the causes of suffering. So like last week we talked about taking the pot off the boil. How do we stop it boiling? Taking it off the fire. They often say about, developing this wisdom, it's like extinguishing the causes of suffering. So let's dedicate. This is the emptiness side of things, and then we'll have the compassion side of things. So the wisdom side, due to these merits, the good vibes, all the good things, the good intentions and effort, which are empty from their own side, accumulated over the three times by me and the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, may the I, who is empty from its own side, achieve the state of Shakyamuni Buddha's enlightenment, which is empty from its own side, and lead all sentient beings who are empty from their own side to that state as quickly as possible by myself alone. So So that's a remembering the emptiness. And when we do that, then it means that all of this merit that we've created cannot be destroyed or lost. And then the compassion side of things. Because of all the merits of the three times created by us and all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and other sentient beings, may there be no wars, famines, disease, quarreling, fighting, or unhappy minds. May there be great prosperity, and may everything needed be easily obtained. May all the human beings in the world be guided by spiritual leaders teaching only Dharma, and may everyone enjoy the happiness of Dharma. May everyone have perfect conditions and have only compassion and love for each other in their mind streams, and may they only benefit and never harm each other.